This is a conversation with Matthias de Vries, founder of Nuclei, who brings deep experience across software development and emerging technologies. Since 2018, he has dedicated nearly all his time to building decentralized AI and data ecosystems that make advanced technology more affordable and transparent. I love how he views data as a new oxygen, fueling his mission to make AI more ethical, transparent, and verifiable for the future. Nice to meet you, Matt. Thank you very much for joining the Humans on AI podcast. I appreciate that. So, Matt, you said that technology is your blood. What do you mean with that?
Well, first of all, nice to meet you as well, and very excited and happy to be here. Thank you for having me so much. What I mean that technology is in my blood is that I've been actually in software development since a very young age. So since 11 or 12 years old, I had this really old computer and nothing was working and I had to figure everything out by myself, right? And someone gave me a book, but it was actually about software development, not really about to get my computer to do the things that I wanted. But then I was reading, I was like, I have to do something. So I got into software development because of that. And at 15 years old, I started to do it professionally, doing it for money. And I did work with many different technologies, many different industries. And I just cannot let it go. I've been in roles where I was only a manager. I had big teams all over the country and I grew into higher and higher roles. And it was fun. I learned a lot from this, but I wasn't coding anymore. And I thought that was like the natural progression of life, right? You start as a coder, you grow into something more, you become a manager, and that's what everyone does, right? And then at some point when I became a founder again, and I was trying to control everything, skill and things like this, I actually went back to coding after a while and I realized this is truly my calling. This is what makes me happy. I love being a founder. I love being to be responsible for everything, marketing, sales, business development, but coding has to be part of it.
Nice. I also read that your entrepreneurial journey is like pretty, it's less than a decade, like it started in 2018. But since then, you've been full on, 100% in. Like I saw that you founded Nextera and you're still working on it because it says that it's kind of like 2018 present, but then as well, you've got the latest one, which is Nuclei as a founder and CEO. And then as well, you have another thing that it seems like it's also current, it's Nuant. So can you explain a little bit, like, are you doing all of those at the same time? How do you do it? How do you manage that? Like, cope with all three companies, being a founder, it's not an easy job at all. It's basically, it's not even a job, it's a lifestyle. Yeah. Tell us, what is the secret?
Very valid question. The secret is you don't manage it. It just happens. And it's exactly like you said. It's not a job. It's a lifestyle. And if it's a lifestyle, like life just happens, right? And I would say this is the same. Like no day is the same. You cannot predict what happens tomorrow. Specifically, talking about the companies that I'm active in, I haven't actually technically started my entrepreneuring experience in 2018. It was actually much earlier when I was 18 years old, but I felt at that time, I did it for 1.5, 2 years. I felt at that time I was a little bit too young. I was a little bit too ambitious. I had success, but I was also making a lot of mistakes. So I thought I will have a job again. I will try again later because I did know at some point it's going to be my calling. So in 2018, I did it. I did it again for real. And that was Nextera indeed. I helped building Nextera for a couple of years and helped create a lot of products together with my co-founder. And then suddenly at some point, one of the products that we've been built had really, it was like apart from everything else that we've developed. So it was already like nagging in the back of my mind for a while that this should rather be a spin-off. It should deserve its own go-to-market strategy, its own people that work on it, and just take it apart from Nextera. So that's what I did. And I mainly focus on Nuclei right now. I would say that 95% of my time goes there. I hold a board member and advisory position in other entities, but I'm not operationally active there right now.
Okay, nice. So you said 18, yes, very ambitious.
Yeah. It was a computer shop actually in where I was surfing local businesses and I was building tailor-made computers for them, desktops. And it was actually very lucrative. But because it was easy and because it was so lucrative, I also made a lot of mistakes. But it was a fun experience. This was really made underlined for me the fact that I need to be an entrepreneur.
100%. So, Matt, when was the moment that you realized that wasn't just a technical problem, coding and solving, technical problems, but as well a human? That's why you became a founder, right? Because as a more than a coder, but when you're a founder, you can really solve real problems for humans too, not only in behind a screen, behind a computer.
I think when it clicked for me, really what the importance of data is, was I think 15 years ago, I was already, data always played a really important part of every job I was doing. I was either working at the data warehouse, doing some business intelligence. There was always a large part of what I was doing, even as a developer, was around data. And at some point, I was working in an enterprise in the Netherlands, so PostNL, it's like the national postal delivery kind of service, a very big company. And naturally, they have tons of data. And at one day, I was brainstorming with someone about, if you have enough data points of a person, you could maybe estimate what's their level of reading, like how well do they understand a specific text, right? And if you speak about mail from the government, mail from utility companies, for some people, they can become very complicated. It would make sense to keep them a little bit simpler. But if you have more smarter, educated people, they might feel a little bit bad by receiving a letter that's overly simplified. They want to be taken seriously and respected with their level, right? So we were trying to figure out, are there a big amount of data points that we can take into account in order to be more fitting to a specific human being, in order to adapt to them, connect to them better? And we never actually did something with that idea. It was just a brainstorm. But that's when it clicked for me, like data, it's so, people say data is the new oil, right? And for me, data is the new oxygen, because we cannot live without it anymore. It's such an important part of us as human beings, of civilization. It's really the oxygen right now. And so it's extremely interconnected with being human.
Yeah, and also talking a bit like data right now, it's for some oil for you, the oxygen. My question is, now with AI, AI takes data everywhere. Now is, I'm wondering, what do you think about the privacy of data and AI and all that topic? That I think it's very, there's a bit of drama in that topic, let's say.
Yeah, I think it's two-folded. I think the level where we're at with generative AI in general, it disrupted so many things. There is definitely a positive impact in a lot of cases, but we cannot deny the fact that the content creators that contributed to the training of those models are losing out, especially about image generation right now, but even copywriting. I think it's safe to say that copywriting is becoming a very hard profession to get into and be profitable. And of course, that's not fair, but it also means that we need to look at more stricter processes around how do we obtain the data in order to train the next generation of models. If we look back in the past, as an example of OpenAI, it was brought to court by the New York Times because OpenAI used like millions of news articles from the New York Times. And they obtained it just by scraping. And I can understand the position of the New York Times. It's their business model. It's all out in the open. Then what are they even doing? So we need specific models in place that help companies like OpenAI to fairly contribute to the content creators for using their content for training their models. Those kind of procedures, those kind of protocols are not really into place right now. Or they exist, web sign behind a paywall, and it doesn't work. We need better solutions than this. It's actually one of the things that we are focusing on from Nuclei's perspective, but one of the more longer-term goals.
Okay, I also hear you guys build Nexus. I'm not sure if Nexus is part of Nuclei or not. Okay, thank you for confirming. And you said in your, I'm quoting a social media post that you made not too long ago, you said, in today's AI era, innovation depends on more than just data. It demands data you can trust, track, and act on immediately. So that's how you kind of build Nexus. So can you share a little bit more about it, how it works?
Yeah, so the core of Nexus is we want to make it easier to work with data. That's like the core of everything. And of course, you know, that means a lot and it means nothing. What is working with data? What does it actually mean? So first of all, Nexus is to make it possible to connect many different types of data sources together and have them available in a unified sort of way. And there is a lot of solutions out there, Braque solutions that offer embedding documents and structured and unstructured data and whatnot. And then you can use an LLM in order to speak with that data, but we take a completely different approach so that you do not lose context, you do not lose details, you have full traceability. And that's really important when it's about data, especially structured data, financial data, people data, any type of data that needs to be real and factual and auditable. You cannot trust an LLM with that type of data without any proper traceability. So Nexus is created around that topic mostly in order to ensure that if an LLM gives an answer based on data or that it needed data for in order to produce that answer, you can click through the steps, what it did in order to get to that answer, where it put the data from, how it converted that data in order to fit into an answer, and stuff like that. And these kind of things are very important because I still see to this day a lot of times that, you know, people, they upload, I don't know, a spreadsheet or a CSV file with some numbers and ask some questions to ChatGPT. Can you sum this up? Can you tell me like how I'm doing with spending or those kind of things? And the first few answers, they're fine. And they keep asking follow-up questions. And then suddenly the numbers are starting to drift because the LLM loses context. It starts to make up things. And it was actually very recent, like a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to someone who was showing me like really long thread that he had with ChatGPT. And he was asking a lot of follow-up questions about a small data file that he uploaded. And I was like, can you verify that somewhere at this end where you are right now with the answers that ChatGPT is giving, if they are still correct? Did you verify? I said, I don't. So we did some quick tests and it turns out it was completely wrong. So he asked ChatGPT, are you still actually using the data or are you just making this up? And it was like, no, these are not real values. I actually was just showing it as an example. So this means you cannot actually trust output of AI. So we need those kind of systems in place in order to make it verifiable, traceable, those kind of things.
You get a good point with ChatGPT and all those threads because I think that we all do it. Like myself, I sometimes write, I don't ask questions and then I have another question, but I follow this. Sometimes I thought of myself asking advice, suggestions every single day, basically, on ChatGPT. And then I kind of get aware. I'm like, okay, I'm doing it. Like, I'm just writing or putting there so many things about myself, like, where is this information go? I start thinking. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm going to say, no, it's not this. It's not. And then I try to trick the thing. But I think, so my question here, I don't know if you have that answer or not, but it's like, where did that information go? I mean, for sure goes to OpenAI, to the company, right? And then with that information, obviously, it's, I don't know exactly, but maybe it's not, it's, maybe I don't want to know.
I would advise anyone to use ChatGPT for personal things, to do a small experiment at home and ask ChatGPT, what do you know about me? Or describe me, describe my flaws, describe what's good about me, you know, things. Describe me as deeply as possible. And I think it's actually very scary what the output is. They do know a lot, and a lot more than you think from your conversation is being saved somewhere. And if it's stored somewhere and that somewhere is not your desktop or your laptop or your phone, it means someone else has that data and is potentially very likely going to do something with that data, even if it's anonymized and it's being used to train large models or newer generations of models for sure. That's why it's very important to be open-minded for open source models that you can self-host, decentralized solutions, stuff like that, in order to combat the larger enterprises like OpenAI.
Oh, yeah. I actually have done that. Yeah, I asked, what do you know? And It's very scary. I'm gonna, like, how can I fucking delete? I'm sorry. How can I delete this? I hear you cannot because they already have it. I paid ChatGPT. So you said if you pay, it's more private, but I don't really think so.
No, that is absolutely not private. No. Yeah, and I did exactly the same, and I had the same reaction. I was very, it was almost like a mirror. Yeah.
I think that we will be cloned.
Yes.
You never know. Okay, Matt. So, talking a little bit about, because I've read that you're very interested to, or you believe a lot about decentralized AI as a way to, because it's a way that you see the future of AI going towards that direction. Why do you think so? Why do you think that it's better to decentralize AI?
I think there is a lot of nuances to this topic. So I'm a firm believer of decentralization, but decentralization is a very complex topic. And full decentralization, especially for AI, is very hard to achieve because of the amount of data and compute that's typically involved. But there are a couple of really good things and projects out there that do an attempt to have a positive impact on AI or AI development specifically through decentralization. If we look, for example, at distributed compute, where you have a bunch of GPUs bunched together and it's very low barrier and cheap in order to have access to that amount of compute, which enables like indie developers or open source developers to be able to develop their own large language models or other kind of AI models in a way that it's affordable and they don't have to go through all the hoops to be able to compete with NVIDIA or OpenAI or whatever. So in that sense, it's very important. And I also believe in decentralized economies a lot, microtransactions between agents and stuff like that. But I do know the fact that we're extremely early there and there are still a lot of steps to be made in order to get there in any serious way or have any real world adoption, business adoption, especially enterprises, mainly because of the fact that if we speak about decentralization, we often speak also about digital assets. And digital assets are still very hard for the bigger businesses to accept as assets on their balance sheet. And they do have still a nasty aftertaste for a lot of people and businesses, unfortunately. So it will take time to get there. But having this kind of autonomy, the trustless nature of doing business or working together has a lot of benefits. There are some areas that would be very hard to decentralize. If we speak about training AI and a bunch of data, like big data, you cannot really decentralize that. You can decentralize maybe access to it. You could distribute it, but full decentralization of big amounts of data is going to be nearly impossible.
Okay, I understand. Do you have in mind any company that they've been able to decentralize something on their either the access to what they do or as an example, can you mention one or two?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually pride ourselves on the fact that we've built quite a massive ecosystem of partners that we collaborate with in order to go through this journey together, because I firmly believe that if you have more startups combined that work together, you can be more powerful. And it doesn't make sense to keep reinventing the wheel everywhere. So we have quite a big ecosystem and some really good companies in there, for example, Fetch AI for decentralized agent economy, but also io.net that delivers distributed compute and hosts open source models on a decentralized network, which we happily offer also to our users, and they can even get started for free with normally paid LLMs without having to upfront any of the hosting costs or whatever.
Okay, I will check them out because I actually don't know that. So Matt, being a person who have started so many startups because you've been a founder in many of them, and when you were younger, so you started by yourself, even though there was not, you didn't find it very, you are not confident to really persuade. But I believe that you've failed many times in all this process, or in this journey of entrepreneurship, right? So what is the main lesson that you've learned in these challenges?
I think it's an easy one, and I think maybe you've heard this one a lot, but it's true. is that you have to find a product market fit. You have to find an actual problem that you're actually solving, that actually exists. And we are very active in the Web3 industry. So that's around a lot of decentralized solutions. And a lot of things that are created there are a really nice solution for a problem that actually doesn't actually exist. And it happens a lot. And a lot of startups do this inside and outside of Web3. And with AI now as well, if it has a lot of hype, it attracts a lot of founders that want to piggyback on the hype and hope for a good ride. But usually they don't actually have a great product market fit. And we actually, so I personally definitely created things that have failed in a sense, that products that I really believed in, was super enthusiastic about, but no one actually wanted. And it's painful to get rid of your baby and accept the fact that no one actually likes it as much as you ever did. But the way to combat that for any founder is to meet people, go out there, have calls, have meetings, and ask away. So from my personal experience, virtually anyone that I try to connect to, even completely out of the blue, completely cold outreach, is perfectly willing to give feedback and insights, especially if you put it around the fact that they have expertise that you're looking for. They're willing to give their opinion, their feedback, their insights, and it's extremely valuable to receive that and should be open for that. And if people say things that you don't like, you should listen even more.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think listening is one of the things that most of people fail in. And I believe founders mostly, because when you have such a belief in one idea, then when someone just say no, that idea cannot be, I feel like it's like you're attacking them personally.
I call it the Steve Jobs syndrome. Like Steve Jobs was a visionary and everyone likes to think they're the next visionary because they have an amazing idea. And they pitch it to family and friends and they are like, oh my God, that's amazing. So they feel like the next Steve Jobs. As if Steve Jobs could come up with all this amazing kind of technology and products and people buy it completely blind and wait in lines for hours when something is introduced for the first day, then my idea would work too. But almost no one is going to be the next Steve Jobs.
Yeah. So, Matt, let's fast forward to 2020. I meant 2030. Yes, I found it so even difficult to say 2030. Like,
but if I can, it's so far away, but we're already halfway there from
2020. Yeah, but that's what even difficult for me to say. I'm like, wow, it's the next decade, but it's 2030. What role do you expect that Nuclei or Nexus play in the global AI and data ecosystem in 2030?
Let's just agree that we should stay another 10 years in 2020. I think it will be much better for everyone. I don't want to go to 2030 yet. That sounds so futuristic. It doesn't make sense. But yeah, how do I say it? That's a nice question. I think by then, we've seen so much innovation in the space of AI, specifically generative AI, probably in robotics, and fully autonomous AI and AI agents that are already starting to take off. And the innovation goes so fast. 5 years from now is going to be absolutely insane. And I think, so someone actually recently told me, and I think I agree with that, is that let's imagine that today we stop all progress on AI, like no one works on AI anymore. And then it will still probably take around 10 years for all businesses to catch up on today's technology, where we froze it. And that actually sounds reasonable. It's very hard, especially for enterprises, big businesses, to adapt this to this rapidly developing innovative technologies. And I think in 2030, we want to be one of the main contributors for those kind of businesses to be able to adapt those kind of technologies much easier, cheaper, quicker. So, you know, that's how I see it. We want to be that company in the middle of all of those kind of businesses that find it hard to adapt to the ever evolving industry. And we just make it that much easier.
And what is the role of the humans in 2030?
The role?
Your opinion.
That's a beautiful question. Oh my God, I love talking about this topic. And I think it's very philosophical, actually. And I think, so for 2030, absolutely no idea. Innovation is going so rapidly right now, but might as well slow down significantly in the next few months for a significant amount of time, because we just topped out on resources, the bubble burst, lack of funding, lack of use cases, whatever. So the role of humanity could be very much the same as it is right now. But looking further in the future, I hope that AI contributes to the fact that humans can go back to the pureness of life and be able to be more involved in a question like, why am I on Earth? And what can I actually do to be happy? How can I contribute to other people to be happy, instead of what kind of job and study do I need to do? How do I survive working from 9 to 5? When in the hell will I be able to go on holidays? All these kind of questions. And I think the role of humanity would be hopefully to go back to our roots and to find a way to be truly happy with all those things that we currently worry about.
Okay, man. Thank you very much. Beautiful ending. I appreciate a lot your time, and thanks again for joining the Himasan AI podcast.
Thank you so much. Wonderful questions. And to everyone listening, an amazing rest of your days.
Thanks for listening to the Humans and AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human, one story at a time. See you in the next episode.